Hey folks, this is Christian, bringing you another episode of the Ice Age Farmer Podcast, mapping a path forward to prosperity, building resilient communities, and sharing knowledge in the grand solar minimum. Today is Monday, August 28th, 2017, and this is episode 12 of the Ice Age Farmer Podcast. We'll be shaking it up a little bit today. I want to start with some grand solar minimum related headlines, some news pieces that are particularly informative to the times ahead. In this case, we are seeing additional moves by the establishment to lock down the supply and distribution of organic food. And I think it's pretty important that we keep our eye on what's going on there and how they're moving to ensure their food security, because that certainly will give us some indicators of what we need to do on our side of things. So we'll take a look at that, and then we'll get into some community feedback, some of the daily steps that folks in the Ice Age Farmer community are taking to ensure their family's food security as the climate conditions continue to shift and more out-of-season weather events and the extreme flooding that we've been seeing around the world, and now certainly plenty of coverage of Hurricane Harvey in Houston and how that's playing out, which is just going to continue to go on from there. It's really hard for me to see because, of course, I've spent the majority of my life in Houston. I'm a native Texan and know plenty of folks that are still down there, so it's hard to watch. I was there for the flooding in 2001 and don't recommend it. If you can avoid the area during a major flood, please do. It's astounding to see that the mayor down there did not recommend people evacuate. But then it should be no surprise that the state is not here to protect us. It is not in their interest to let us know that hurricanes or grand solar minima are approaching, because they might lose control. And that's what they're there for. And that's what the state does, is ensure its own survival, not ours. So it's not a surprise. But I digress. We will talk about steps that people in the community are taking to ensure their own food security in the times ahead as individuals, because the state is not doing that for us. And then we will get into the special. So last time I began the first part of a two-part special looking at the very basics of good soil and plant husbandry. Last time, chiefly, we focused on the microorganisms and the cycles that are going on in every plot of functioning soil. And so today, we'll take a look at the basic biology of plants, their parts and how they work, and then some particularly tasty, notable exceptions to those typical morphologies. And I think it'll be good to sort of cover some basic ground there. It's a refresher for most of us. But a lot of us will stand to learn from that, so it's I think it's helpful. We'll be then doing the crop focus. Today I wanted to speak to brassicas, because I've been saving seeds from my mustard and some arnica and some other things, and the brassica family, broccoli, all these things look like it would be a good candidate to cover now, because that's what I find myself taking care of. So we'll speak to that. And then I'll be finishing today with an icebreaker, something a little bit different today, but it seems like it's in the field. I just saw Jill Elizabeth posting a video about her thoughts on how the grand solar minimum is being crafted, shaped, so that it continues to remove people's power as individuals. And that's actually exactly what I wanted to share today, is a piece by John Rappaport, who is for years speaking to this, but particularly well, I think today puts it, the battle between the individual and collectivism or globalism. And so I'll be sharing some thoughts there, particularly on how building strong individuals and being an independent, inspired consciousness on this planet is what makes you uncontrollable. It makes you a survivor and someone who can thrive even in changing times. There's really not much to fear when we think for ourselves. And so I think that's a good piece to share, and that's why I'll bring that today's show. But before we do all that, I do want to remind you that Ice Age Farmer is available as well on YouTube and on Stitcher and iTunes. So I've got links to the podcast from iceagefarmer.com to all of those presences, so that you can share out with whatever medium your friends or family seem to enjoy. You can give them the appropriate link. I'm trying to make this information and this show as easy to share as possible, because I think it is absolutely crucial that we share the information with folks and make sure that as many of us are aware and preparing for the times ahead as possible. So I appreciate your sharing this out. And with that, let's get to the news. I have for some time been covering the updates on the Gujarat flooding in India and Bangladesh. That's now affecting over 640,000 farmers and nearly 1.1 million hectares of farmland. These are obviously huge disasters on a human level, as well as very real problems for crop production on an agricultural level. And both of these things are relevant and interesting here, which is why I keep running updates on twitter.com/IceAgeFarmer, where I keep a sort of the fire hose of all relevant news going. And here in the podcast, I try to keep it to things that are specifically able to help us craft a better vision of where we're going in the future and the effects from the climate conditions we're going to have to deal with. Today, I mean, it is obviously, I just have to acknowledge, as we already have, how out of control Harvey is. It looks like as I've been saying, the flooding is growing increasingly frequent and increasingly severe. And so it's not a surprise that North America finally gets its own taste of it, which will force it. My hope, the silver lining around Cloud Harvey would be that this reintroduces some element of questioning into the otherwise lately unthinking people that I'm surrounded with, who are, you know, talking about Antifa, but don't have any idea that we're entering a grand solar minimum and that food production is actively failing around us. Prices are rising and the shelves will soon be empty if major changes aren't made. And I think those changes start with the individual. So, after the eclipse, it looks like the United States is getting its own taste of those things. And yeah, I'm hoping that it helps shift our image parameters slowly, that these things aren't fine across the world, that they are happening everywhere, and that we need to start making changes in our own lives. We'll let that be my hope for today. And of course, my prayers go out to everyone down there still in Houston and around the area. But what I did want to focus on today, because it's absolutely critical and criminal, and I think highly informative as to where we are in the timeline of what's going on and how it's playing out. The filthy, rich, cryptocratic folks, the guys who control things, they, whatever you want to call them, the elites, I don't want to call them that, are actively right now making a grab for the production of and the control of the distribution of food, period. I've covered before when the Amazon transaction purchasing Whole Foods was announced, and it was the change in control happened today. Prices were slashed up to, and in some cases, more than 50%. So already, just from this weekend, you walk in Whole Foods today, half price. You no longer have the normal price discovery going on. People don't have any idea how much their groceries actually cost to grow anymore, because Whole Foods is not, it's not a farmer's market anymore. It's not, if it ever was, it's now the kiosk of Amazon.com and the elites, and they will put whatever price tag on that food they want you to perceive as its cost, because they will absorb the rest, as Amazon.com has for years done in their gradual suppression of all retail and making sure that they undercut everyone and make suppliers go to special deals. I mean, this is all of these things, all of the havoc that has been wrecked upon retail for the last decade and a half is now coming home to roost in groceries. And you see that with the loss in their market caps this week. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about how these people, the co-founders of Google, Sergey Brin, Asia's third richest man, Li Ka-shing, and Facebook's lesser known co-founder, Dustin Moskovitz, Bill Gates, the other former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, all of these people are involved. In fact, Elon Musk's brother, all of these people are involved investing in ag tech. And specifically here, I mean agricultural technology, technology that is specific to recreating a new way of growing crops that will work in the future that they know, like you and I do, is coming. They are well aware, given their position and their influence and their resources, of the fact that the climate is changing and not in the way that the global warming AGW nonsense has popularized, continues to push. Man, someone on my Twitter, I have to thank them, the other day just did a search in Google News for global warming and did a screenshot and said, what is going on? Who is paying these people? But the truth is that it's a $4 trillion industry, right? The Paris Accord was a $4 trillion commitment. At any rate, these people are taking control of our food supply. When they purchased Whole Foods, they gained the ability to put whatever price they want on food now. All the other groceries are going to have to compete with these price levels. And so we have lost that pain point. You know, I've said before, and other people say before, when people are finally having to pay double or triple for food, then they will no longer be able to deny that we've entered a time of rapidly changing climate. And this is exactly what has been precluded, or at least stalled, delayed in this transaction. Whole Foods can now make you think that food is whatever price they want you to think, because they're bankrolled by Amazon. So at the same time, these other folks that I mentioned, the big names that I enumerated, are all investing in animal-less, meatless proteins. So meatless meats. The largest of these is Impossible Foods, who's taken down $75 million. Now, folks, they will give you a cover story, an elevator pitch. Oh, my wife and I really like animals, and so we wanted to find a way to make meat that doesn't hurt animals. This is bollocks. This is ridiculous. It is insulting that that is the story they tell us. As I mentioned, they know what's coming. They're watching as the climate destroys our agricultural systems, and they are rapidly standing up, both because they like to eat and they want to continue to eat, and then also because they'll be able to make bank from these new agricultural systems, the vertical farming like Plenty and these animal-less meat sources. So I mentioned Impossible Foods. It's taken on over $75 million in their latest round, this one from Li Ka-shing and Bill Gates. It's not because they care about the animals. They are producing something they called a bleeding burger, which sounds disgusting to me. And I love beef. I love burgers. The FDA refuses to approve this bleeding burger because of some additives that it has in it. But that doesn't stop people in the San Francisco Bay Area, at least according to the mainstream media here, from being totally overwhelmingly in love with it. It is taking the Bay Area by storm. Now, let's step back a second here just to briefly remind ourselves, in case we've forgotten, that the era we live in here is perfect corruption. The corruption is absolute. It is perfect corruption. Yes, I'm talking about the media being Washington Post. Washington Post is praising these companies who are creating meatless burgers. But wait a minute, Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos. And now that he owns Whole Foods, is Whole Foods going to... Yes, I don't even need to finish the question. Yes, Whole Foods announced last Friday, 4 days ago, that they will now be integrating Impossible Foods, Bleeding Burgers restaurants into their now Whole Foods retail establishments. So you can go shop at Amazon.com and purchase your Echo right in Whole Foods, along with your organic groceries at whatever price they want you to think they are. And at the same time, you can buy your meatless burgers, all of it sponsored by 2 to 3 people, right? The founder of Amazon and the founder of Google. I'm sure they're going to give us some free Wi-Fi. Oh, it's going to be a wonderful prison, folks. We're going to love it. We're going to love our servitude straight out of Brave New World. Look, they are, I just can't help but mock the situation. They are actively and so aggressively, this has all happened in the last 30 days here, while we're very well distracted, I should say, constructing this food prison. It's not a food desert anymore. It's a food prison, and it's being built all around us actively. And we need to be very aware of it, because nothing else should be the only rational response to these things that I just told you are going on. You can go see that it's going on right now. The only rational response is to start growing your food now, is to start taking control of your food supply into your own hands. Because these people, as we saw and as we're seeing from other government responses to major crises, they don't care about us. It's a big club and we're not in it. They do not care if we have food on our table. As long as they are in control, that's all that matters to them. And so it is up to us. We are responsible for there being food on our table at the end of today and tomorrow. And all of our actions better reflect that reality. Everything we're doing better support our ability to feed our family going forward. And with that, let's get back to our next segment here on a podcast about how to feed our family going forward, the Daily Step section, feedback from the community. Today, I heard from Claudia Hansen, who reports in from San Diego, that caterpillars have stripped her strawberry, kale, potato leaves, and damaged peppers and tomato leaves. Saw several people confirming Claudia's comment. Eric G. in Massachusetts, there have been a lot of episodes of chilly weather this summer. The warm weather does not last. We usually have at least one heat wave a summer and just haven't this summer. We did have a brief warm spell, but it feels like fall, frankly. Chris Young chimes in as well. The same thing in Ohio. We've had a wet summer, which should be good, but lows in the mid-70s this month when it should be 85 degrees. If you want to know your future climate, just reduce the normal highs and lows by 30% for every month. Nice guess there as to what things might contain. Claudia Hansen continues, she has had only 1 in 10 flowers pollinated on her squash and her cucumber. Indoor solarium hydroponics doing well, except where the moths and the caterpillars were able to get in there. Her LED lights run 7 hours a day. Very low maximum temps in the 60s, which is unusual for August there. 4 local cities in the last few days there have reported their lowest maximum daily temperatures, breaking multi-decade records. So, chilly in San Diego, late in August here. I also heard from A. Pearson, who let us know that while she is temporarily without a home, not to worry, she's using this time to learn and to prepare on fruit, because the seed comes with the fruit. She's learning how to save and store seeds from any fruit that she comes across, and preparing and storing the seeds for future cultivation. As well, she's currently looking into the wild world of purchasing land via tax auction. That is a wild world indeed. And refining a list of must-haves to help guide that property. Have you made any purchases on properties, sites, for yourself? We'd love to hear more about that. Send me a note, icehfarmer@gmail.com, and let me know how you went about that process and then how it's worked out for you, what lessons you think would be great to share out with the community. I'd really like to help folks through that, and I'm looking into doing something on finding a site for myself as well right now. But it's, as you know, a huge process. And then on some more weather check-ins, multiple folks from Australia were passing on word that the winter does not yet show any sign of slowing down there yet. It's still cold as a, quote, dead dingo's donger, according to Sir Bobby, letting us in on some of the Australian vernacular there. Canberra experiences freezing by day. There's snow falling across the city. That was Sir Bobby. Also heard from Tired of Government Overreach. Nice name there. Who has been mentioning that she and her husband are calling this month Augustober because it's so cold, it doesn't look like a summer at all. And then finally from Super Dip Monster, sort of confirming the video that I posted of crop losses at a West German farm. He's in northern Germany and says that there has not been a single day this summer that's reached over 30 degrees Celsius. Normally it would be 34 degrees for days at a time. But that just hasn't happened this summer. It's been a real outlier. He cycles to work. It was 7 degrees Celsius just at 5:30 in the morning, which is not too far above freezing for those of us in the Fahrenheit mindset. Otherwise, it's just raining all the time. Yeah, so a cold, wet summer reported again from Germany. And that was what led to the loss of the wheat crop that I had posted a video on, and how farmers at this biodynamic Demeter certified farm are actually still letting their fields lay fallow, waiting for the insurance adjusters to show up. Tough to hear. All right. So again, on the daily steps, what are you doing to ensure that your family has food on the table tomorrow and going forward as we see the big money positioning itself in alternative agriculture? So too should we. And I just can't stress this enough. Be creating our own systems that are going to take us into the future. That's going to be traditional ways that people have gotten things done. And then I think, too, some pretty creative solutions, some new techniques that involve technologies and knowledge that has been sort of disparate across the world that we can really bring together here in this community to help guide all of us forward. So let me know what you are doing and how that's working. Send me a note, iceagefarmer@gmail.com. And with that, let's get into this special section on plant anatomy. Last time we covered soil and some of the natural cycles that make growing plants possible, and in fact, life on Earth possible. So we're making some headway into the large ecosystem. And today I want to continue that and remind ourselves a bit about the basic parts of plants, and then some, you know, the properties that they share, and then some notable exceptions that we enjoy eating to those more typical morphologies. So let's start here. Why not? Most plants are not edible. Go figure. We can't do cellulose, and that rules out a good amount of plants. But a lot of plants have cellulose in their cell walls, and that's in fact what makes them plants. And that's why we can't digest them. So beyond that, most edible plants are actually edible only in part. And usually it is one of the parts that has a specialized function. So higher plants usually have the following. They'll have flowers, stems, leaves, roots, fruit, and seeds. Not all plants have each of these parts. In fact, for example, a cactus has stems that are also acting as the leaves. The stems themselves of a cactus do the photosynthesis and have chlorophyll. But usually they do have most of these, and they're usually pretty identifiable. Most plants that we grow for food, most edible plants, are biennial. That means they store energy and they'll grow throughout the first year so that they can then quickly flower and seed early in the season of their second year. And what we do then is allow that and nurture, cultivate that first year of growth, try to maximize the amount of energy that the plant stores, and then we harvest that energy before it goes to seed. So that's why we don't want lettuce to bolt, or anything to bolt, or vegetables to go to seed, is because they spend that stored energy that we are hoping to use. It also explains if you check out, like if you dig into your beets or your carrots after letting them grow to seed, so deep into year two, they're shrunk and they're tougher because they during the first year they store the energy and the moisture and everything down in those tubers, and then in year two they expend it and shove it up into their seed pods, into their seeds, because that's what a seed is it is a maximally compacted piece of energy and genetics required to take that plant into the next generation. All right, let's take a look at each of those parts that we just identified. So roots. Roots are the interface with soil, which we talked about last time in episode 11. They absorb all non-organic nutrients via the water. So in absorbing water, they take up nitrogen, phosphorus, potash, the trace elements. They also store some food. Sometimes, and like the beets and the carrots we just talked about, those are usually the swollen taproot from a tuber. And you can see that out of that taproot, the taproot is a main root that goes straight down. In fact, when you plant something like an avocado tree, it shoots down this big single root. And then out from it come what are called lateral or side roots. And you see the same pattern in carrots, parsnips, beets, radishes, rutabagas, turnips, sugar beets, even although they're storing sugar and not as much starch. In fact, most stored energy is in starch, but because starch is not soluble, which is why it makes a good way to store it, when the energy is still being transported around a plant, it's still kept as sugar. And this explains why when you're looking to get tasty potatoes or sweet corn, you need to harvest those guys before they finish the process of storing that sugar, before they turn all of their sugar into starch, because then they taste nasty. All right, let's keep going. Stems. Stems are, I mean, everybody knows what stems are, but there are some interesting examples of those, some interesting cases. A potato, for instance, isn't actually a root. It's not a tuber from a root. A potato is a stem. It has no lateral roots coming out of it, which helps to point to indicate that. The eyes are actually other stems that are coming out. And the way you definitely know is if you, we've talked about this before, the importance of hilling potatoes. If you neglect to hill your potatoes and get them exposed to sunlight, then they will turn green. They will start photosynthesizing and they become inedible when that happens, which is why you want to hill them. Kohlrabi is another example of a stem that stores energy and becomes an edible vegetable in this case. So when kohlrabi does not need to be blanched, it's an unblanched, which means you just let it get sun and that won't ruin it. Whereas the potatoes do need to be blanched. So you keep them under the ground in the dark to make sure that they don't start photosynthesizing and become inedible. What are some other blanched vegetables? Other vegetables we keep out of the light are celery stems, sea kale, chards, the stems of cardoons. The stem of rhubarb is also edible. That's the part that we, when you have a strawberry rhubarb pie, you're having the stem of the rhubarb plant. In fact, the leaves of rhubarb are poisonous. So, all right, let's talk about those leaves. Leaves we're pretty familiar with. They are often edible. Some special leaves have evolved to store energy. You can think of onions, leeks, garlic, shallots. The leaves of cabbages that have hearts are similar. And then others like lettuce are sort of halfway evolved in that direction. They store a bit of energy in tight clumps of leaves that will overwinter and then flower early and go to seed. The big division in the seed department is the monocot versus dicot, which many of us still remember from elementary school biology, but the key of it there is mono versus di, right? So a monocot is a single indivisible seed. It comes up with one stem, one sprout that comes up from the ground, and then sort of grows from there, thinking about onions, leeks, asparagus, even sweet corn here. Whereas a dicot, which is most things we think about, you can tell that the seed is two parts. So you could actually break most dicot seeds in half and see them being roughly the same therein. They sprout up with two little seed leaves, and then a stem comes up from them. And then those two leaves start collecting the sun's energy beyond what the seed had in it. And it is using that energy that the first true leaves will grow. Sunflower comes to mind as like just a very archetypical and beautiful sprout that comes up. It's got two seeds and then the stem keeps growing from there and additional sets of leaves come out from that stem. That's a typical dicot pattern. All right. Let's keep going. Flowers are not usually edible. This is the part of the plant that does the reproductive functions. They're usually not edible, but they are fascinating just in terms of the innumerable, highly creative ways that the plants have evolved to get various forms of life, usually insects and birds, to do the heavy work of pollinating them. They are highly bespoke, right? They're very specifically designed to attract insects, usually, to that nectar and to get them to do the pollination, but not self-fertilize. So in many cases, the biology is like pushed out far, so that it won't be self-fertilizing in cases where that matters. Bees are great for doing this. In fact, part of being a self-sufficient gardener might involve keeping bees on your property to help you with fertilizing all of your crops that you need help with. Otherwise, you're going to be, if it's totally indoors, and I've been here, you're running around with a paintbrush pushing into your flowers. It takes a lot of time, and it's not the best way to do it. The best way to do it would be to have a system that does it for you, right? So bees are fantastic. Plus, they give you honey. That's a great, great thing to consider. Some other plants like corn are pollinated only by the wind, and that's why you would want to plant corn for successful reproduction in blocks of the crop as opposed to one long row, where that fertilization via wind is much less likely to actually take place. There are some edible flowers we can mention here. Cauliflower is one, broccoli is another. Those have been over many, many generations turned into varieties. Those are the young flowers that you're eating there. Artichoke is another one. Nasturtiums is one that I like to grow just because I like calling them nasties. All right, let's keep going. Fruit. Most of us think of, actually, we have sort of a misconception of fruit. Fruit is, by definition, any of the fertilized ovaries of the plant. And this actually does include all nuts, tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, bean pods and pea pods, not the pods themselves, not the peas or beans themselves, those are seeds, but the pods are flowers. And then you can get super technical. Like, it turns out that raspberries and blackberries aren't actually blackberries, they're fruit clusters, because each individual node on a blackberry is by definition a fruit. And then conversely, where a berry's definition is that it's a collection of many seeds suspended in sort of a pulp. And so tomatoes and oranges, by that definition, are two examples of biological berries. So I don't really want to get into that, because I think it's getting confusing when you mix the colloquial and the biological definitions here. But fruits in general have a lot of sugar in them because they're storing up energy with those seeds, like we talked about. But they also have some vitamins, notably vitamin C is usually found in fruits. And finally, seeds. Seeds, of all the things we were mentioning here, basically are responsible for keeping the human race alive. All cereals are seeds, and that includes wheat, rice, corn, right? The absolute staples, at this point at least, of human diet are seeds. And there's a good reason for that. We talked about it a bit. Plants are shoving every bit of nutrition, every little sliver of energy that they can manifest is being pushed into those seeds. Like the Japanese subway at rush time, they're just getting shoved in for future generations to use that energy to grow. That's true of all seeds, and that's why they are usually action-packed. Leguminous seeds also are huge plant-based protein stores. Peas and beans. Soybeans as well have a ton of protein. It's almost a complete protein diet right there. In fact, if you add some comfrey in for B12, you very nearly get there between a few extra vegetables and then those leguminous protein seeds. They're also super easy to dry and store, which is another good one. Pea was the crop focus of the last episode, episode 11, if you're interested. And so seeds get a lot of attention, and it's worth talking about. And then finally, it's also worth mentioning herbs. They're usually used to flavor food, but they also have a ton of different medicinal properties, which is actually the more interesting in my book, the more interesting aspect of them here, especially as the medical system to which we are, for better or worse, accustomed at this point in time continues to just grow off the charts in terms of costs and finally ceases to be available mercifully, then I think we will be very quickly exploring the properties of essential oils and other quote-unquote alternative remedies that have been shoved under the Rockefeller belt of the Western medical system. And as I've mentioned before, I hope to get into some of those alternative techniques, especially colloidal silver is one I'd like to explore. But here, I think that's enough for the special intro to plant biology today. I hope these last two segments have been helpful in setting the stage for what a plant is and how it grows, and then how now we can turn around and build upon some of this knowledge and play with pyramids or electroculture or whatever methods we feel are promising. But if we can't get these basics down, then it's not worth having those other conversations. All right, for today's icebreaker, I want to do something a little different, sort of a moral barometer by which we can gauge whether ideas or solutions are good ones or bad ones. Most of us are familiar with the Hegelian dialectic, by which the controlling cryptocracy, the ruling non-elites, are able to create a problem and then propose a solution with that problem so that it's pre-suggested and it's the obvious one that the sheeple will find themselves shepherded into. So it's the problem reaction solution approach. And one of, as I was saying, the barometer by which you can generally gauge these solutions to be A, the ones that were pre-suggested by the controlling elites, and B, generally bad ideas that strip us of our individual liberties, is this dividing things into two categories. They are either reinforcing and strengthening the individual, as this country, the United States, was founded upon the truths, the spiritual truths of consciousness, the unit of consciousness being an individual, the sovereignty lying at that level, and any abstraction upon that, any collectivism over that being not true, being wrong, and basically a mechanism by which the individual is made to be the slave to the collective. So John Rappaport, of whom I'm a fan in general, is particularly clear at enunciating this difference. And I wanted to share a piece that he put out just last week on the 20th called The Individual Versus Globalism. And I'll only read some selections from it, but I did want to share it because I think it really offers, you know, a lot of folks are saying, what's wrong with global warming, or why don't you think we should save the Earth? Well, that obviously these are you know, suggestions that no one can disagree with. No one would disagree that we need to be good shepherds of our environment and of this planet. No one would disagree that we should save energy instead of being wasteful when possible. These are the false conclusions that come from global warming that are used to make people seem like monsters if they don't go along with what is the obviously anti-human, anti-growth agenda that is lying underneath that green surface. And you can tell when you look at the way Rappaport describes it, as this is it's framed as a global problem that requires a global solution, a global coordinated response. And that means that the needs of the individual are necessarily subjugated underneath that global solution and this thing that requires a global government. So when their solutions, and even, they're not even talking about solutions, we're only using language right now, and we're saying, look at these solutions all indicate the need for something that's bigger than us to solve the problem for us, like a superhero from the movies. And I'm here to tell you, and that's why I'm sharing this today, that's just not the way it is. All solutions are going to come from the individual. And I love Rolf Wischke, and when I listen to him talk about moving our growing to floating islands right along the equator, I think that's a great idea, right? I think, obviously, if we could pull it off, that'd be fantastic. I'd love to see our global food supply moved in a direction that's more resilient so that we would have a better chance of faring this as a species. Unfortunately, that is a global solution that requires a global controlling, at least some high-level controlling interest, and subjugates all of the individual's needs to people who are there to implement it. And that means I don't see it happening, or even if somehow this thing were catalyzed and started to happen, I would see that effort being taken advantage of and abused by and taken control of and working ultimately against our interests, because that's just what happens when power is centralized, is it's taken control of. All right, so let's go ahead and get into John Rappaport's piece here. Global solution means the individual is cut out of the equation. He doesn't count. He doesn't mean anything in the larger scheme of things. He's just another pawn and cipher to move around the board. This is purposeful. This is the script for the future. Create problems whose only solution appears to be collective. Psychologically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, divert the individual's attention from his own vision, his own profound desires, his own imagination, and place it within the group, all of humanity. Propagandize that idea that if the individual concerns himself with anything other than the group, he is selfish, greedy, inhumane. In fact, he's a criminal. More and more, this is how the young are being trained. The grand we is sold to them like a cheap street drug. They buy in. They believe this we is real instead of a hollow con designed to drag them into a globalist framework owned and operated by megacorps, banks, foundations, governments, and ubiquitous Rockefeller interests. And what of the individual? His mind, his unique perception, his independent ideas, his originality, his life force. And indeed, from an Ice Age farmer perspective, his sovereignty, his food security. All of this is swept away in the rush towards, quote, a better world, a better we. Going back as far as you want in history, shortage and scarcity in the world have engendered a crisis that was either created by some elite or maintained deliberately by them for the purpose of eradicating dissent and fomenting a collectivist solution, meaning a solution that came from the top, meaning a solution that reduces individual freedom. In recent human history, the last 200 years or so, a different idea has emerged. Establish severely hamstrung government in order to protect the individual against it. As I said before, Ice Age Farmer, the United States was founded on these spiritual truths that came across the Enlightenment, the Reformation. Individual is sovereign, and everything beyond that is an artificial construct that can only be very tightly controlled to protect those individual spiritually true rights. Right? Government is a fearful master, dangerous servant. This idea has had a very tough time of limited government. Collectivists have fought it every step of the way. But regardless of circumstances, the individual can author his own freedom and what it implies. He can discover within himself extraordinary possibilities. He can contemplate what it means to create reality that expresses his most profound desires. And then he can begin a voyage that no one and no group can stop. Civilizations do come and go. They rise and fall. But the individual remains. Another side note, this is a great reason that you and I can enjoy having no fear. Just in our being individuals and stepping into our own power, we are already among those who can survive and thrive during these difficult times. The word imagination, when properly understood, indicates that the individual can envision and then create futures that never were and never would be unless he invented them. Imagination is the opposite of provincial, restricted, well-known, familiar, or accepted. Imagination is the challenge to the status quo. It is the true threat that the individual poses to all predictive systems. Therefore, when they use PSYOP code phrases like, it's all just information, trying to impress upon us that ideas, thoughts, nothing is original. It's all information being shared in the collective consciousness, bouncing around the internet. We are all just meme machines. The individual means nothing. This is the opposite of the truth. This is absolutely false. The individual invents everything. He cannot be predicted when he is acting as himself. He is not a pattern. He's not a system. He's not anyone else. He thrives on his own inspiration, walking with spirit. He is the ultimate riverboat gambler. He bets the house on his own as yet uncreated future. He's not a piece of universe. He's not a humble servant of order. He invents the space and time of his own time to come. In 1961, healer Richard Jenkins explained, quote, "People are confusing their own empathy for others with some inflated idea about group identity. These aren't the same. People are becoming afraid of their own unique and distinct existence. This is a social fear. A new social contract is being foisted on the population. Either you belong or you have no rights." This is a completely totalitarian concept, and it's coming in through the back door. Well, now, friends, it's right there at the back door, at the front door even. The individual still has our choice. The question is this: are we moving on the ground of our own independence, building our own futures? Or are we searching for a group life raft, a raft of collectivism to which we can attach ourselves without thought or hesitation? And this, I think, as I mentioned, is a helpful barometer in general. It's also part of the reason why Ice Age Farmer style solutions to the grand solar minimum and the many problems that are befalling us left and right are all ground up. They are all beginning by building each of us up as individuals, becoming more self-sufficient. Resilient communities start and are built upon resilient individuals. I imagined this show into existence because I know these climate changes are real, and the threat resulting to our food security is real, and to our physical security. I know as individuals we take our cues and we inform our own personalities even, and our attitudes, based on the people around us with whom we spend our time, even the people to whom we listen. I think we needed more positive voices around these truths, so that more of us can help each other move in the right direction here, right? That's what the daily steps towards self-sufficiency are all about. But bear that in mind when you select to whom or to what you give your attention today and every day. You are greatly influenced by the five people to whom you give the majority of your attention. So pick carefully. In fact, more generally, always remember this: whatever you are doing right now, you're getting better at it. Your brain is right now optimizing itself for doing whatever you're doing in the future. You'll be doing it better tomorrow. Even if you're wasting your time, you'll be better at wasting your time tomorrow and ignoring the things that need to get done. And if you're growing plants right now, you will be better at growing plants tomorrow. Take joy in that. So use your moment wisely. Choose wisely, because we're always building our futures, whether or not we're doing it consciously. What future are you building? And with that, I hope you enjoyed today's show. I hope you got something out of it. If you did, please spread the word, pass it on to your social networks, let other folks around you know what's going on, pass a note to the dude in the subway, do what you gotta do. But we gotta start getting the word out, folks. So please spread the word about what's going on and about the Ice Age Farmer podcast and the YouTube channel. This has been episode 12, Mapping a Path Forward to Prosperity, Building Resilient Communities, and Sharing Knowledge in the Grand Solar Minimum. Let's go build a future where the individual is sovereign and empowered and is totally secure in his food supply. Join me.